From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is underway, an opportunity here for us to offer you some insight, if we're lucky, at least some commentary and analysis on the news media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Dr. Alan Shartok of Northeast Public Radio, and Ira Fussfeld, the publisher emeritus of the Kingston Daily Freeman and Associated Publications down in the Hudson Valley, and Judy Patrick of the New York Press Association, formerly the editor of the Gazette in Schenectady. Here we are, Judy, Ira, Alan, and Rex.
Good day, everybody.
Yeah, let's get ready to rumble.
Yeah.
Get ready to rumble.
Alan's busy with his little pile of bacon over there. We need a little protein, bacon. You know, to get himself going here for the show. You ready?
No.
Okay.
I don't think I would have ever expected to see Alan Shartok eating a piece of bacon.
Really?
No.
No, bacon is allowed on the Whole 30 diet because it's protein.
The Whole 30 diet, yes, but... Well, anyway, it's
he's
a good
not
thing.
Sharing, just for the record.
Oh, yeah, here, pass it down. There's a lot in there.
Hey, we have a win to celebrate here, ladies and gentlemen. So rare for us to report a victory on the Media Project. We've talked to you about the tariffs on Canadian newsprint imposed by the Trump administration, which were imperiling a lot of newspapers. The U.S. International Trade Commission has overturned the Trump administration, unanimous decision by the 5-member body eliminating those tariffs. I might turn, Judy, first to you, because the association you now work for represents a lot of these small newspapers that were really imperiled by this, right?
Yeah, you know, I say hooray to this. This is really good news, but, you know, a significant amount of damage was done, and who knows what will happen going forward. I mean, the industry is under so much pressure, and they were trying to anticipate these enormous cuts. I mean, as much as 20% increase in newsprint costs, which is a significant amount of every newspaper's expenditures every year. And pages were cut, and I'm not sure these things are going to be restored. I mean, in many cases, they will be restored, but that's what I worry about is the companies have seen, okay, we've cut Saturday's publication, and the readership doesn't seem to be reacting overtly. What I worry about is the continued loss, the shrinking, and the amount of news that the public is getting. And while I am very happy that the tariff has been resolved, I am still furious that we had to go through this in the first
place. Too bad the commission doesn't have the power to say you have to pay them back everything they lost.
Well, I agree totally with Judy. You know, we'd rather not have the tariff than have the tariff. But in the amount of time that it was in effect, it cost the industry millions of dollars that we're not going to see again. As Judy suggests, there have been cuts that have been made that probably won't be restored. And it still doesn't address the bigger, longer-term problems that the print industry faces. So, you know, we're happy to have this, but I'm not doing cartwheels, even if I was physically able to do cartwheels. By the way, I did not realize that there was such a thing as the U.S. Trade Commission that could overturn the president's edict. That's sort of encouraging to me that there are those checks and balances out there.
You say U.S. It's international, right, Rick?
Well, it is it's the U.S. International Trade Commission. Yes. It is a federal body that specifically is aimed at how the U.S. government treats international trade. So, yeah, it's a U.S. thing.
Darn, Ira was right.
Yeah. Anyway, it is something that we have to keep eyes on, you know, because newsprint traditionally has been the second highest cost factor for newspapers after personnel. Nowadays, actually, in our business, digital media fees are exceeding the cost of newsprint. That is, what you have to pay to the software providers who put advertising and features on your website, we actually end up up spending more for that stuff now than we do for newsprint. It's just an amazing cost. So that when you get a dollar for an ad, for example, on digital, you don't get to keep that whole dollar because you have to pay so much to the software.
That startles me. I've been away from the business too long, but if that's the case, and I have no reason to doubt you, that takes care of the argument that newspapers need to continue cutting print because it's cheaper to run the digital operation, and you're saying it's not cheaper. So now what? Because there's not nearly as much revenue from the digital side.
And the margin is much lower on digital, in part because you have to pay for the software that carries all those ads. And that is one of the reasons why you don't get the dollars back, even if somebody who has given you $100,000 a year for newspaper advertising gives you now, says, transfer it all over to digital, you don't get to keep as much of it.
Well, Rex, being the naive one on the panel, I want to ask you guys a question. I don't fully understand that. So why can't you get your own, you know, for want of a better word, geeks to do this work? Why do you have to put it out there?
Well, there are many different digital media fees. I mean, some of it is people who bring you digital ads that you have to air, that they're out in the ether, and you actually have to pay for the service of using those ads. You also have to create the ads. You can have your own staff of digital creators, but that's tremendously expensive too. If we were to hire our own video producers to produce these high-end digital ads.
And a company as large as yours does not have that service? Because I believe my former company does. We run an operation called Ad Taxi, which is in effect an ad agency for digital advertising that works on behalf of all of the newspapers in our company.
We have, each of our newspapers actually has an affiliation with a digital player. Yes, we have some of that. But remember, you worked for a company with hundreds of newspapers.
Yeah.
A newspaper division of my company, Hearst, is actually the smallest division.
Interesting.
And a smaller, like Judy's paper, which is a one-off, basically, a single newspaper, you're not going to be able to hire digital producers.
You know, I'm a little interested in Donald Trump, of course, enters into everything we talk about. Here's a guy who declares the press the enemy of the people, right? And so now this commission comes along and unanimously slaps Trump's hand, basically, saying you can't do that. One wonders when they're sitting around and what's floating around in their subconscious, whether this is a way of sort of saying enough.
You mean on the Trade Commission?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they were able to study the impact of the tariffs. And don't forget, the reason for the tariffs was because a newsprint producer,
one of them
in Washington State, was suggesting that it was being hurt by the fact that there were no tariffs. And the commission did a study and found, no, that's it wasn't hurt, and let's get rid of the tariffs. Although I'd like to think that there are people out there trying to figure out a way to slap this guy down. I'm not sure that was the case here.
Well, I'm glad you raised that, Ira. I of course, disagree with you.
Which part?
The whole part.
Oh.
But the issue to me is that, you know, they were able to overrule one complainant. And as you know, facts are facts and theory is theory, and you can find what you want when you want to find it. Don't you see?
Well, I was glad to see that the system apparently worked. And I've
always wondered. Yeah, because
you won. Right, it's true. But I always wondered why President Trump never really tweeted about this issue, and he hasn't hesitated to tweet about other issues. Why didn't he, if this was a big issue for him, why didn't he step forth and lobby for it?
I think it's a little complex for his Twitter feed. So anyway, that's issue number one. We will go now to an issue of journalism ethics that's going to be kind of fun. By the way, if you want to share your thoughts, media@wamc.org is how you can send us email. We're always happy to get it, media@wamc.org. So speaking of Trump, Alan, interesting story has emerged over the past week involving Lanny Davis, the lawyer for
Michael Cohen.
For Michael Cohen, thank you.
Who was, there are so many of them.
Scorecard lineups.
Right. This has to do with the fact that there was a CNN story some months ago in which the sources said that Cohen would be able to testify, that Donald Trump knew in advance about that now infamous meeting at Trump Tower in which Russian agents met with the president's son and son-in-law, supposedly to share dirt on Hillary Clinton, which was initially billed as being about adoption, you know, so there have been lies about this from the get-go.
Right.
But however, it emerged, Lanny Davis now says, no, actually, I have no such information that my client has that knowledge. What has emerged from this is a question of this. If your source on a story, your unnamed source, if you create a story that hinges upon somebody in part, at least part of the story, hinges upon someone being an unnamed source, you need to protect that source's identity. Can you, in the text of that story, also give that same individual a no comment? Say that, in effect, Lenny Davis, the lawyer for Michael Cohen, had no comment if perhaps he was actually your unnamed source for that story. Sounds of questionable ethics, right?
Yeah, I don't know how often, if at all, this
is done. What is your name,
Alan? Oh, I'm sorry. Was your name?
Go ahead. Take your call on me and your answer.
All right, well, let's start that over. Try reintroduce it, and we'll cut that out.
What do you think, Ira?
No. I apologize. No, you go ahead.
No?
I think it's a questionable ethics, and I don't know how often that this occurs. I suspect it probably occurs more than we realize, but this story has become a cause celebre on the right because it suggests that CNN, which is already a villain on the right, had made up a story out of whole cloth, and that Carl Bernstein, who was one of the byline reporters on this story, is somebody who the right would love to take down. So it's just a piece of that. And incidentally, Bernstein and CNN is saying they stand by the story. Right. So that aside, but this is a distraction that is, for ethics interests such as ours, is troubling.
And one of the reasons it is so troubling is that it is Carl Bernstein, of course, who was the, you know, one of the two guys who brought down the Nixon presidency. And so this is a double joy for the doubters here. Nevertheless, it sounds reasonable to me that the president knew about it. And if, you know, I'm willing to go with Bernstein and with the WAPO on this. But Rex's point is extremely well taken. What if you find out that your source doubles back? Now, what if, for example, just for example, and this is a hypothetical, the president leaned on Lanny Davis, or his president's people leaned on Lanny Davis, and he got nervous. They had something on him or something like that. If that were the case, you can just see that when sources change the story, it may well be not that they were wrong in the first place, but that they have succumbed to something else.
Can I weigh in here? I don't think this is questionable.
He didn't call on you.
I didn't think this is questionable. I think this is outright wrong. If you quote someone and they're your unnamed source, you cannot say in the same article that they could not comment. You are misleading your readership when you do that. That's wrong. It may be a minor point in the larger issue here about what Lanny Davis said and how good a source he is, but CNN was wrong to do that. That is just
verbal. Wait a second. What if CNN was right? What if CNN had other sources? What they're saying, they're standing by their story.
No, they're saying that the Davis would not comment for the story, when in fact he was commenting off the record for them.
You know, it's an interesting point. I remember the first time I heard somebody put this notion out there. It was the editor of a major metropolitan newspaper, winner of a Pulitzer Prize. And I had not heard of this idea before, that it is okay, this editor said, to do just what you're saying is deceptive. It is deceptive to say so-and-so said no comment. But consider, for example, Henry Kissinger during the Nixon administration when he was Secretary of State. That was Alan doing his Kissinger invitation.
A good one.
Can we hear it again?
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. Dr. Kissinger would oftentimes talk with reporters and require that it be attributed to something like a source close to the Secretary of State, and they ended up adding who's thinking often aligns with the secretaries and who travels with him, meaning the secretary's brain.
And who is him.
And who is him. But because he was the Secretary of State, diplomatic niceties being as they are, it would be inappropriate for such statements to come from the Secretary of State's mouth. They could, however, come from an official thinking of the administration's thinking. So now, that's a little bit different, but not so much.
Well, no, it's exactly the same, because I can't recall. Obviously, I haven't scrutinized thousands of stories, but if they use Henry Kissinger as a source, as an unnamed source, they didn't in the next paragraph say Henry Kissinger could not be reached for comment or had no comment.
Yeah, but it's a slippery slope. The whole thing is a slippery slope, right? That you have granted somebody permission to say something that may or may not be right, and that then they start to make other demands, like you lie about who the person is, because that's a lie. Isn't it a lie when you say somebody who is close to the Secretary of State, when it is the Secretary of State? That's a damn lie. And, you know, the you people really ought to be...
you people.
You people who engage in this kind of thing and who are so sanctimonious about everybody else really ought to be calling them out for what it is.
Right, and the person reading that story or listening to that report would say, oh, well, it wasn't Kissinger who said that. I mean, the average person isn't going to know the insides of this, and that's why you have to be abundantly clear, and you can't mislead your readership when you're writing these stories.
Right, and you know, it's so interesting, Judy, this business of how the rules work. So yesterday, even I told the reporter who was here something I shouldn't have told her. I shouldn't have told her. I told her a story, and I shouldn't have told her. I said, and by the way, that's off the record.
Haven't we taught you, and more, you better
that,
than that?
And you see, that isn't off the record. I knew it, of course. I've been teaching that to my classes for years. So that's right. And we happen to have a sliding scale of agreement on what's off the record. So if you take somebody who's in the Rotary Club, who really doesn't know the rules, you have to give them a little bit more slack than if you're dealing with a public official of some kind who certainly does know what the rules are.
You're right. I think, however, that what we're seeing here is putting out for public visibility something that actually happens more often than we know. This action of allowing someone to say, I had no comment for the record.
But being the source.
Yeah,
but
being the source. I suspect that happens all the time.
If you look very closely at the way things are phrased in these stories, and as Alan points out, the typical member of the Rotary Club reading a story is not going to notice that. But it is a nuanced way of writing the story that allows somebody to be a source and still be not for comment. For example, if you have a major law enforcement source, let's say you have someone who is, I'm making this up, the Deputy Attorney General of the United States, who we know perhaps has back-channel communications with reporters, or people in the Trump White House. You know, the Trump White House leaks all the time. There's a lot of stuff that comes out of the Trump White House, but then there are statements in these stories saying there was no comment from the White House. That's the kind of thing that is pretty routine now in American journalism.
And it all comes from the fact that you people want the story. You want the story.
Why do we want the story? We want the story for our readers.
That the public deserves to know these things.
Yeah,
that's
there
the, where
go.
It all comes from that.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's greed on the part of the... it's greed on the part... We want the story. There is no story without the source.
Uh-huh.
So therefore, if the source is haggling with us and negotiating terms, we're going to give them their terms so we can have our story.
It's my observation that the press was vilified long before Trump about the use of anonymous sources. The public didn't like anonymous sources, and that the industry seemed to be using less of them unless it was absolutely impossible to advance a story without using an anonymous source. So I wouldn't beat on us so much. I think Judy is right. The obligation of the journalist is to get the story as accurately as they can, and if that means it needs to use anonymous sources... And the anonymous source, the identity of the anonymous source is made aware to the editor or whoever the superior editor is, then you go ahead and do it. What we see Trump tweeting this week, and it's rich that he's doing it since he used to be the go-to anonymous source in the New York tabloids, is Trump is saying, don't believe any of these anonymous sources. The journalists are making them up. Well, sorry. Those of us who know something about the industry from the inside know few, if any, sources are made up.
Well, let me go back to Rex here. Rex is a very bright guy, and he's been around for a while now, and he knows the stuff. So here it is, Rex. The most famous off the record, the most famous anonymous source, of course, was Woodward and Bernstein. The so-called deep throat.
Whose identity they kept secret for decades until he
turned out to be the deputy
near his
director.
Deathbed was ready to be outed.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so Ira, interestingly, gave us the justifications for this. But as I remember it, Rex, and you are in a better position to handle this than anybody I know, in that very case in which Ira just said the editor has to know who the source is, right? The editor didn't know.
No. The editor is the key word here.
Because there were several.
Which editor? Yeah. We have a requirement in our newsroom that an editor, a supervising editor, needs to know who the anonymous source is on stories because you're in effect creating a contract between your news organization and that anonymous source. It isn't that I have to know as the editor of the newspaper. It depends. But we don't want a reporter just sort of freelancing out there saying, yeah, I'll keep your name secret and not being able to share it with one other person. Now, I think that happens happens sometimes in my newsroom as well as elsewhere, where reporters kind of casually give off the record. And we have to constantly remind people that this is a really difficult issue because you need information that sometimes people don't realize that there'll be ramifications for them, negative ramifications, perhaps losing jobs, losing a lot more than that if their names are identified. But we don't casually give out the promise of anonymity. What about if your unnamed source is a guy named Brett Kavanaugh, now the nominee for United States Supreme Court? Brett Kavanaugh was an aide, remember, to Ken Starr when he was pursuing Bill Clinton involving what turned out to be an investigation involving Monica Lewinsky. We call it the Whitewater probe initially, which had ended up having nothing to do with Whitewater. The president was impeached, I think, because sanctimonious members of Congress couldn't stand the idea that he was having sex. But the notion is that...
Which is unknown in the U.S.
But here's the thing. I mean, there is a significant implication that we draw the inference from things that Kavanaugh has said, that he has said in interviews, that he was among the sources leaking from the Starr investigation. So here's the question for the reporters who were covering back then. As Todd Gitlin has written in Columbia Journalism Review, it's a stark conflict between their professional code, don't name your sources, and a First Amendment obligation to inform the American people about the record of a judge about to receive a lifetime appointment to the, you know, the most important nine-member legislature in the world.
I like it, and you are exactly right. Nine-member legislature is exactly what it is. It's a political body with Democrats and Republicans on it.
I couldn't resist throwing that in. But so do you break your word to Kavanaugh from 30 years ago that he's an anonymous source if you're somebody like, say, Mike Isikoff, who was a reporter then for Newsweek, I think, and now is the chief investigative reporter for BuzzFeed and is frequently seen on MSNBC? Do you break the name and go with that, or do you always preserve that promise of anonymity?
I think this is easy. No, you don't break your word. Never. I mean, unless it was...
You take it to the grave, Judy?
Take it to the grave unless someone's life's in danger, someone's national security is in danger. There are a lot of politicians who are off the record sources. You don't see reporters standing up before every election saying, this guy told me stuff off the record he probably shouldn't have. This district attorney told me this he probably shouldn't have.
Well, how about the guy broke his word and he gave me something off the record when he was a public official, but it was a lie. And I want to go on record now. I've been living with it all this time. I printed the story. It turns out it was a lie.
Yes, I think you have a point there. To this writer, Todd Gitlin, who is one of the thinkers about these issues, he says, to my mind, if Kavanaugh leaked from Starr's office and is covering that up, then he is ethically disqualified to serve in the Supreme Court. Reporters owe us and the Senate information that helps us determine who deserves a spot on the highest bench in the land. If the person was leaking negative information about the president during the investigation.
So what we have here is Maslow's concept of descending priorities. On some cases, you should, and on some cases, you shouldn't. If a guy's going to be on the Supreme Court, yeah, we should know everything, and we should know whether he screwed around with the truth or whatever and leaked. And if it's just a common, you know, guy on the street, not necessarily.
And I think there's something to that. This is why we have humans doing journalism rather than machines. A minute ago, we were talking about the slippery slope. I think we live on a slippery slope. I mean, I think a lot of these issues really require us to think about what is the higher value, right?
Sure. Is it more important that a corrupt Nixon gets impeached, or is it more important that we keep our word as journalists?
Well, look, this is an era in journalism, and this is an era in our country where a lot of the norms have been ignored or have been changed, and a lot of reflecting and soul-searching has to go on. And the rules by which we in the journalism business lived for decades may not apply anymore. And I think that's something that there's going to have to be reflections in the think tanks of the journalism circle.
I knew this guy up here, Rex, you know him too. In fact, we all know him, who went around. And one day he said the most remarkable thing. He said, on the air, but he was a reporter, I have a source, and he's a good one.
Well, I always hated when somebody would write according to a reliable source. Well, why would you use an unreliable source?
Right.
let's start from the premise that the source is reliable.
All right, we got to go for now. We have Judy Patrick and Ira Fussfeld and Alan Shartok, and I'm Rex Smith. Thank you for joining us on The Media Project.
Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the world.
Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. Judy Patrick is the Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association, and Ira Fussfeld is the Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.